From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, Cannabis Control Commissioner Shalene Tytle on equity in the marijuana industry.
The complexity of cannabis and the complexity of racial justice and social justice and economic justice all aggregated together is a challenge I think unlike any other.
She's here to take your calls. Also today,
Little Roller up along first, behind the back, it gets through Buckner, here comes Knight and the Mets win it!
We remember former Red Sox Bill Buckner, and a new podcast investigates the unsolved murder of James Reeb, a Boston minister killed in Selma, Alabama during the Civil Rights Movement.
It would seem as though his would have been solved quicker, and all of it would have come to the light because he was a white man. Why is it so hard to find these people who know about Reeb?
That's all next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Let's begin today with a remembrance of Bill Buckner. The former Red Sox first baseman played for 22 years in the major leagues, including four seasons with the Sox. He died yesterday at the age of 69, following a battle with dementia. Boston has a tradition of venerating our biggest sports stars. Think Bobby Orr, Big Poppy, Ted Williams, Pedro Martinez, Larry Bird, and of course our current GOAT, Tom Brady, and so many more. And Bill Buckner could have joined the pantheon of Boston sports legends. He was an all-star and gold glove infielder and one of the best hitters in a generation. But his career in the city has instead been defined by just one moment, a stunning game-ending mistake in the 1986 World Series. WBUR's Anthony Brooks brings us this report.
In baseball, it's better to be lucky than good. Bill Buckner said that, and he should know he was very good and then very unlucky. So you know what happened. It was 1986, the Red Sox versus the Mets in Game 6 of the World Series, with the Sox one strike away from winning their first championship since 1918. Then a couple of hits, a wild pitch, and suddenly the game was tied and the Mets' Mookie Wilson at the plate.
Little Roller up along first, behind the back, it gets through Buckner, here comes Knight and the Mets win it!
The ball went through Bill Buckner's legs and the Sox went on to lose Game 7, and Buckner was forever tarred with that one error. It was so unfair because Buckner was so good. He was an all-star who almost made it to the Hall of Fame. He won a batting title. He had more hits than either Joe DiMaggio or Ted Williams. But one unlucky moment and two decades of being good didn't seem to matter anymore. So Buckner went away and eventually settled in Idaho, where he could hunt and fish and live peacefully with his family, far from the relentless reminders about that error. He did a bit of major league coaching in the 1990s, and then in 2011, he came back to professional baseball in Massachusetts to become the manager of the Brockton Rocks, a semi-pro team of baseball dreamers. That's when I met him and learned something about his grace and modesty and about his courage. Here's a little bit from that piece, beginning with the sound of some young autograph seekers greeting Bill Buckner. Buckner is a minor celebrity here in Brockton, about 30 miles south of Boston. On a recent evening in Campanelli Stadium, there were about 200 people in the stands, and one man dressed as a kangaroo. That's the team mascot. Bill Buckner was in the dugout musing about baseball and luck.
You know, baseball is a game of failures, you know, and a lot of downs in the game, you know. You had to shake it off, and I mean, the good players can do that, you know. I mean, baseball is a game of averages, but over a short period of time, to have a little luck going, it's not a bad thing.
Buckner gets tired of having to relive and talk about that error. But on this evening, he brought up the subject.
People always ask me what I thought about, you know, when I missed the ground ball. And my first thought was, wow, I get to play in the seventh game of the World Series, you know.
Right.
You know, we'll get them tomorrow.
Of course, the Mets won Game 7, and the Red Sox had to wait another 18 years before they finally won the World Series. After that error, members of the press wouldn't let it go. So those were tough years for Buckner and his family. One reporter even called his wife to ask if Buckner was contemplating suicide.
Yeah, I took some cheap shots, you know, and I had to get over that. You know, I mean, I had to forgive those people. I mean, like, you try to carry that burden too much, you know.
Number six, Bill Buckner.
So this is what happened when Buckner came back to Fenway Park in 2008 to throw out the first pitch of the season opener. Boston fans gave him a huge ovation, which Buckner talks about in an aw shucks kind of way.
It was awesome. I mean, it was almost embarrassing, though, to be out in front of that many people. And the real cool thing about it is that fans were, they were sincere, you know. And
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think they were totally sincere.
I think they understood, you know, all the crap I went through, and they were always good to me.
So that was back in 2011 at Campanelli Stadium in Brockton. Buckner told me that baseball gave him a great life and he wouldn't have traded it for anything. He said when you're 12 years old, you dream about hitting the game-winning home run in the World Series, but he said that doesn't happen too often. Not without a bit of luck, anyway. Bill Buckner died early Monday morning after battling dementia. He was 69. According to a statement from his wife, Jody Buckner, he was surrounded by his family. She said Bill fought with courage and grit, as he did all things in life.
WBUR's Anthony Brooks with that remembrance of Bill Buckner.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
With almost two dozen Democratic candidates running for president, one area of policy that has provided some daylight between them is health care. To that point, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has reintroduced his Medicare for All bill. A handful of candidates has signed on in support, while some others say it's the wrong policy prescription at the wrong time. Last week on Radio Boston, we spoke with John Kingsdale. He's a Boston University professor and a key figure in bringing universal coverage to Massachusetts. He told us that he thinks the Democrats who support this idea could be on the verge of making a huge political blunder.
It could turn what has been the number one policy advantage for Democrats, what really helped Democrats take back the House in 2018, into a huge political liability in 2020. And frankly, Republicans are salivating at the prospect of running in 2020 against Medicare for All.
And we promised last week that we would follow up on that conversation with a physician who supports a single-payer plan. And so, sticking with our promise, let's turn to Dr. Adam Gaffney. He's an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School and president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, as it's entered in the political conversation, Medicare for All, single-payer health care, they've kind of become these nebulous ideas, political jargon. So let me just ask you specifically, what do you mean by Medicare for All?
By Medicare for All, we mean a single public plan that would cover everybody in the United States from birth to death, comprehensive benefits, no onerous copays or deductibles, and you can see the doctor or the hospital you want, not the one your insurance company tells you to see.
Okay, and is that the same as the bill introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders?
There's a bill in the House introduced by lead sponsor Pramila Jayapal, and there's also the bill in the Senate introduced by Bernie Sanders.
So in thinking about this idea, you've been a proponent of single payer for years. Of course, we heard John Kingsley at the top there argue that in his view this isn't politically smart. Sounds lofty. Sounds amazing. Sure. No copays. Choose any doctor you want, any hospital you want. But tell me why you think this is the right approach right now.
Well, let's put it this way. We spend $3.5 trillion on health care a year in this country. Despite that, we've left 29 million people uninsured. Being uninsured is an issue of life or death. I, for one, have seen patients in the ICU with conditions that could have been prevented through medical care. Meanwhile, there's 44 million people underinsured right now. That means that Americans are going without needed care, not because they're uninsured, but because they're insured, but it's not good coverage. It has too high copays, too high deductibles, or the networks are so narrow, you can't actually go to the doctor that you need to go to.
But what about this idea that you're handing the Republicans a you know, political victory here by pushing this hard this soon?
It is nonsense. The reality is that polling has consistently shown that majorities of the nation support Medicare for all. It has been shown again and again and again. And physicians also have supported this. A majority of physicians have supported Medicare for all. It's a very popular program, and for a good reason. This is an issue that basically everyone in this country is dealing with.
So if you think about the American healthcare system as a massive ship, I mean, you're talking about turning it completely around very quickly. And you know, one of the major concerns that we heard from John Kingsdale is that there would be a huge disruption in one of the biggest sectors of our economy. So I want to play another clip of tape because he's worried about that drastic change.
Not only is it putting $2 trillion or more a year in from the private sector into federal taxes, which will create all sorts of winners and losers, very disruptive. It means taking some 16 million jobs and pretty much cutting the funding available for them. Because if you're going to fund through taxes a much more generous benefit package, as Senator Sanders has proposed, you're going to have to cut the payment rates for those services.
Now, Kingsdale is one of the architects of the Massachusetts healthcare reform, Romney Care, that became the model for the Affordable Care Act. So how do you respond to his concerns there?
First of all, the idea that it's going to be so disruptive is exactly what people said in the 1960s before the implementation of Medicare. The idea was that seniors were going to fill up the emergency rooms and there wasn't going to be enough money to take care of all these patients. It was false. It worked out fine. And as a result of that political bravery, we now have a program that provides universal care, not perfectly, to our nation's seniors. It's time we did that for the whole country while also improving the coverage for seniors. In terms of the idea that we have to cut payments to hospitals and doctors in order to make Medicare for all happen, not true. The big savings come from the enormous amount of waste in our private health insurance industry. Quick fact, 12% of every healthcare dollar that private insurance companies get goes to their profits and overhead and administration. The figure in traditional Medicare is 2%. That is an enormous difference, and it translates to hundreds of billions of dollars of savings.
But what about those 16 million jobs that Professor Kingsdale is talking about? You know, I remember during the Obamacare debates, if you like your doctor, you can keep it. You can keep your doctor, you can keep your health plan. That, of course, turned out not to be true. So how do you explain away that disruption that will have? There will be winners and losers. There always are. So how do you explain that away to the losers?
First off, people care about access to doctors, hospitals, medications. They don't care if they're covered by Cigna, United Healthcare, or Aetna. They don't care. They don't have brand loyalty to their private health insurance companies. They want access to doctors, hospitals, medicines. And so Medicare for All would not take away a single person's health care in this country. It would simply mean that it's being paid for by the government instead of by private insurance companies.
But it would change.
It would change for the better. It would upgrade coverage for the vast majority of the nation. I mean, look, it's not as though we're talking about a system that hasn't been done elsewhere. You look north of the border, Canada. You can see a doctor get hospitalized. You'll never pay a single dollar out of pocket. And there's 0% of the country uninsured. Again, we have 29 million people uninsured. Go to Scotland. You don't pay copays for medical prescriptions, for prescription drugs. Meanwhile, seniors are going broke in this country buying – I've seen seniors say that they're not actually able to afford their inhalers for emphysema because the copays are too high. I mean, what kind of nation is this that we allow this to happen? We have to do something. And the idea that doing nothing is more politically expedient belies the experience of millions of Americans who are going without needed care every year, 25% of Americans actually.
Well, I don't think folks are arguing about doing nothing. I think the argument is – incremental steps or improving what we have, improving on the Affordable Care Act. Would you support incremental steps to maybe get to Medicare for All but not immediately go there?
I think you have to look at what is the best policy solution for the problems at hand. If the problems at hand are uninsurance, insurance waste, prescription drug being unaffordable, then Medicare for All is the best solution. Look, we've already taken a big incremental step. That was the Affordable Care Act. It did a lot of good. It reduced the number of uninsured by 20 million, but it left the big problems unsolved. The next step is a public system for everyone.
So another major concern of the folks who oppose single payer is that since Medicare pays lower rates for the same services, some hospitals, maybe rural hospitals that are already struggling to stay open, will be forced to close, resulting in the loss of access to care. What's your response to that concern?
Well, that's a great example of how the current system is failing. Rural hospitals are going bankrupt across the country. Women can't get access to obstetric services in large swaths of the nation. So the current system is obviously failing. Medicare for All, and the way we envision it especially, would give lump sum budgets every year to hospitals to cover all their operating expenditures. So we're not talking about, you know, slashing hospitals' operating budgets. The reality is you need doctors, you need hospitals, you need prescription drugs. You don't need insurance companies.
So you're saying you're not – you wouldn't be slashing hospital budgets, but at least according to the New York Times, the payments that hospitals get at Medicare rates now, you know, and if you spread this out over all hospitals, would be at least 30% lower than private insurance. That's a huge loss in revenue for hospitals.
Two things. First off, hospitals would achieve enormous savings under Medicare for All. Currently, hospitals spend 25% of their operating budgets on administration and billing, armies of coders to deal with multiple insurers. Under Medicare for All, we can expect that would fall to half. Second, no one has said that hospitals have to get paid a certain amount. That has not been decided. And the reality is we need to – whatever bill passes, it will provide sufficient money to hospitals so they can maintain the current quality and quantity of care provided, if not increase it.
So under the current system, a lot of folks, most people, get their health insurance through their employer. And if that cost moves to the private, you know, from the private sector to tax revenue, how do you make sure that workers aren't going to get stuck with the bill, you know, getting paid the same salary, but now paying more in taxes to support this new healthcare system?
Very simple. You replace much of what employers are currently spending on healthcare with an employer-side payroll tax. Employers might spend less than they're currently paying, but they'd still do their part to pay for the system. That's a very easy problem with an easy solution.
You say an easy problem with an easy solution, but I'm thinking of Congress and the presidency. And how does something like this get passed?
How has any major social change been accomplished in history? A movement of people working together with a common goal in sight. Look, I'm not naive. I realize this is a big, you know, push, and this is going to encounter enormous obstacles, particularly from corporate interests that really benefit from the status quo. But we can do it. We've seen great change happen before. We've seen the civil rights movement. We've seen gay marriage. We've seen all sorts of other changes. But yeah, there's a long way ahead.
So the Affordable Care Act gave millions of people access to insurance coverage, and yet was used very effectively, as we talked about, by Republicans against Democrats. And John Kingsdale, who we spoke to last week, told us he thinks we could see even more backlash from a switch to Medicare for All.
You're talking about huge levels of disruption, tens of millions of people who will end up paying more in taxes than they currently pay or think they pay in premiums. So it's not just some people on the margin being disadvantaged. It is literally tens of millions of voters thinking, boy, I just got screwed in this deal.
So last question for you, Dr. Adam Gaffney. Why do this now all at once?
Because Americans can't wait. A quarter of Americans are not getting the care they need every year because of costs. People are dying. This is a moral cause, and we have to win it.
That's Dr. Adam Gaffney. He's an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School and the president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Gaffney, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. In Massachusetts, there are at least 19 licensed recreational pot stores, but according to the Boston Globe, not a single one involves an applicant from the state's social equity or economic empowerment programs. Now, this can't come as great news for Shalene Title. She's one of the five commissioners on the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission. Title's focus on the commission is social justice, which she's here to talk with us today. Commissioner Title, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me on.
And listeners, we also want to hear from you during this segment. Do you think the state is meeting its equity goals when it comes to the rollout of recreational marijuana? Do you have questions for Commissioner Shalene Tytle of the Cannabis Control Commission? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So first, I want to ask you, because last week on Radio Boston, we spoke with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and we asked him, you know, what the holdup was for recreational marijuana stores in the city of Boston. And he told us, basically, ask the state.
They have 9 applications up there right now, and we'll wait. You know, there's a process that goes through here that we go through the city of Boston and go through the zoning commission and the zoning committee, and then we put it up to the state. So I was asked the question the other day by an applicant, where's my license? I'm like, well, where is it? He says, at the state. Well, you have to contact the state because we've done our part.
So can you shed any light on what the holdup is as far as opening recreational stores in the state's largest city?
Sure. Well, we issue more licenses at each meeting. Our next one is coming up this Thursday. They're generally first in, first out. We have priority applicants, economic empowerment priority, and medical priority. So if they're in, they will be reviewed and the commission will evaluate them.
So we're not sure if any are coming to Boston quite yet.
Well, there's a lot of integrity to the process. So as a commissioner, I see it when it comes before the commission in public.
So Thursday, potentially, you might see one from Boston, or you can't even talk about that. Okay.
The agenda is posted online for Thursday, actually.
So 19 recreational pot stores that have been licensed as of last week. And as we mentioned, not a single one involves applicants from the state's social equity or economic empowerment programs. You're the social justice chair on the Cannabis Control Commission. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so let me tell you about a couple of very new initiatives that we've made. So at our last meeting, we approved social consumption and delivery licenses. And these will be exclusively for economic empowerment and equity program participants. That program is just getting underway, and other small businesses.
So what does social consumption mean?
So social consumption can be cannabis cafes or event licenses. So we actually, you may remember, approved these in December 2017. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of pushback that it was too much too fast. So we went back to the drawing board. This one is a very incremental approach. It's a pilot program. It will be in 12 municipalities max. And most importantly, we're going to keep the data not just on how this is working for equity program participants, but in terms of public health, public safety, underage access, impaired driving. And that way, everyone can make decisions about whether to expand the program based on the data.
So you mentioned that the legislation required priority to be given for businesses that already have medical marijuana licenses. And you know, a lot of those places have been able to quickly transition into recreational. But again, social equity applicants have not. Why is that?
So there's two categories, economic empowerment priority. And this is a designation that merely gives you priority in the licensing process. So you get reviewed first. I think what we've learned and the approach here is we try different things, what works for equity, what works for diversity, and we're honest about it. I would say that approach of priority in the process without support service, it hasn't really worked. Now, the equity program, that's technical assistance, that's fee waivers, and now we're the first state to do exclusive access to licenses. We're trying that. I think that's going to work well. If not, we'll try something else.
So you say it hasn't, that at least that first prong hasn't really worked. So why not? I mean, I guess what went wrong?
Well, we did a survey, mm-hmm. and the top three barriers to entry that they named are a lack of capital. And of course, that's very common and an obvious one, given that businesses can't get loans from banks because of federal prohibition. And we can talk about the Senate
amendment.
Yes,
we will.
Yes. And then an issue with the local approval process, that's been very difficult to get through, particularly for smaller applicants. And then just needing some more time or some more assistance with starting up a business and writing a business plan.
1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you have questions for Commissioner Shalene Tytle of the Cannabis Control Commission? Again, give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. So you mentioned this idea of banking and funding. And last week, the state Senate rejected a proposal that would create no interest publicly financed loans for people to get into the business who have previously been affected by prohibition on marijuana. And State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz said that she will try again after more details have been hammered out. And you support this effort. What still needs to be worked out? And is there support there for this idea?
Yes, there is so much support for this idea. I think that, of course, it's disappointing that it didn't go through last week, but the proposal from the commission came in April. So I was actually very pleasantly surprised to see Senator Chang Diaz being so proactive. There was a lot of support for it. I think that there is general widespread support and looking to the commission to say, what tools do you need to get to this vision that Massachusetts voters and legislators had of a diverse industry with small and large businesses. And a big piece of that is access to loans. So I have a lot of optimism that this idea will be worked out more and that we will see a social equity loan fund.
So she said, Senator Sonia Chang Diaz, to the Boston Globe this week that, quote, every month that we don't act is a month that market share is getting claimed and eaten up. So every day, really, that's happening. Do you think the state is moving too slowly on equity?
Well, no matter how fast we were going and no matter how much we were doing, I would say yes, because I don't know if we can ever make up for the harms that were done with the drug war. But I think we need to do as much as we can, as fast as we can.
I want to take a call here from Amel from Dedham. Welcome to Radio Boston. What's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I just have a quick question, and I appreciate the commissioner being on. Let's say that I would like to get into this this business, into the market. And I'm a small, I own a small farm, and I'd like to start growing and start contributing. What would be the avenues that I would need to go down, or really basically how would I start if I would like to work with vendors and really get involved in this? I'll hang up and take the answer online. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for your call. Commissioner Title?
So let me point you to an underappreciated resource, I think, which is the guidance documents on our website, masscannabiscontrol.com. And if you click on guidance, you will see information about all the different types of licenses, including craft cooperatives, which provide special benefits for farmers, and specifically guidance for farmers as well. So if you're interested in any type of license, that's a good place to start.
Great. I do want to play a clip of tape here from Tito Jackson. He's a regular contributor here at WBUR. He also runs a cannabis company, Verdant Medical. He's a former Boston City Councilor. And he told us that he views one of the central hurdles for minority applicants who are interested in getting in the industry is money.
The problem really is the barrier to entry is about $1 million per store. And understand, this is an industry that is unbanked. You can't go to the bank down the street and ask for a loan because it's not federally legal.
So how can the state help those, you know, those folks who want to get into the industry but can't get those kind of loans?
First of all, I'd want to thank then Councillor Jackson. He was the first elected official in the state, actually, to endorse legalization. I think that Senator Chang Diaz's idea of a loan fund is the most straightforward way to provide capital. I also think that even though the commission shouldn't be making loans to businesses that we regulate, I think there's a lot that we can do in terms of making these businesses attractive to investors. And a big piece of that is the technical assistance and the business training, showing them how you can have good corporate governance, how you can have good hiring practices, how you can run a business well so that investors will want to invest in you.
Let's take another call here. Jenna is calling from Littleton. Jenna, what's your question for Commissioner Title of the Cannabis Control Commission?
Hi, my question for the commissioner is, what is the CCC planning to do about applicants who are coming forward who appear on their face to not be involved with a cannabis company that already has 3 established retail licenses, but perhaps is providing 100% wholesale contract and incubator support to, like, the little guy, but in fact are very much perhaps a front for a company that's already received 3 licenses and are going ahead.
Great. Jenna, thanks so much for the call. Commissioner Title?
Yeah, it's been so great to get more of these questions recently and seeing all the attention paid to this, because it's really important. For me, the other side of equity is you have to help small businesses, but you also have to make sure you enforce our license limits. So we've been discussing this all along. You can see in our regulations passed more than a year ago that we have very strict ownership and control limitations. You can see the details on that on our guidance for businesses. And I can see also that local governments are now paying attention to this. So I've been asked a lot, what can we do in terms of host community agreements, in terms of requiring disclosure of management agreements? I think you'll start to see that now, not just at the state level, but at the local level as well. And I think it's something that it's on us to be diligent about, and we are.
You are. Okay. Well, let's take another call here. Josh is calling from Danvers. Josh, you're on Radio Boston. What's your question for the commissioner?
Yes, ma'am. Thanks for coming on air today. One question I have, and I think a lot of people, in the state are kind of have the same question, and that is, with science out there with drunk drivers, we have plenty of science to find intoxicated drivers. But what science is out there to basically find people under the influence of marijuana when they're driving? And perhaps that's why, we're having some skepticism with the banks and the funding issue.
Got it. Thank you, Josh from Danvers, for that call. 1-800-423-8255 is the number if you'd like to join Commissioner Shalene Tidal of the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission. How about that, Commissioner Tidal? What's in the pipeline in terms of the science on impaired driving?
So the state law, the same one that created our commission, also created a commission on impaired driving that met several times. It had experts from law enforcement, scientific experts, civil rights experts, and they issued a report with their recommendations. And the general gist of their recommendations is that we don't have a tool that's exactly equivalent to, say, a breathalyzer, but what we do have is drug recognition experts. And so they recommend that we have more and that we continue to be vigilant about making sure that people who are driving are not impaired.
So I want to ask you about something you mentioned a little earlier in our conversation, delivery services. And I'm just wondering how that might work.
So, look, we have five people on the commission, five different areas: social justice, public health, public safety, government regulation, and business. So you can imagine coming from those five perspectives, deciding what delivery should look like was a very robust, ongoing conversation. But what we currently have decided is that delivery looks like a license where you can purchase from a retailer and then deliver to a consumer with very robust regulations and security requirements.
Could you deliver to someone in a town where there's a prohibition on marijuana?
So you have to follow our meeting on Thursday and Friday because that's on the agenda. And there's definitely some questions about that. I personally question whether we have the authority to limit whether a person can receive a delivery of cannabis if they're over 21. But there's differing opinions on that.
So the commission's still deciding it. Sorry. And you were explaining the rest of the program. Continue.
So for me, down the line, the goal is to have what I call a non-storefront retailer, where you would act as a retailer. You can wholesale cannabis products and then deliver them, but this is a lower capital license, so you wouldn't have to invest in real estate. And this is a successful model elsewhere. But at this time, we're focusing on purchasing from retailers, delivering to the consumer, making sure we have those regulations implemented. We test them out, and then we can move on to the next phase.
We have another caller who has a question for you. Brian is calling from Worcester. Brian, you're on Radio Boston.
Hi, I just had a quick question. I was kind of confused. So the commissioner said something about people being disadvantaged by the war on drugs. I mean, if people are doing something that's illegal and they're getting arrested for doing something that's illegal, how is that disadvantaged? I'll take my call online.
Great. Thanks, Brian. Commissioner Tidal, respond to that.
So it's very well documented, not just in Massachusetts, but across the United States, that Black and Latino people specifically have been disproportionately harmed by the war on drugs, disproportionately arrested and incarcerated relative to the rate of usage, which tends to be equal. And so there is data, you can find it on our website, you can find it elsewhere, that shows those disparities. And also, our equity programs are focused on a evidence-based study of geographic areas of disproportionate impact as well.
So I want to ask you about the prevalence of the black market in this industry. BDS Analytics, a cannabis market research firm, found earlier this year that some 75% of the pot sold in the state this year will be under the table. And they estimate it could take another 3 years or more before enough stores are open to make a dent in the black market. Are you surprised by that number? Is there a concern there? And what's the commission doing about it?
I'm not surprised by that number. So if you ask an expert on the illicit market and the general transfer that happens after legalization, that number is about what you would expect, or even maybe a little better than you'd expect with the number of stores that we have open and the number of the amount of time that it has been. And we are very steadily going in the direction of more stores. And research shows that consumers tend to transition based on availability of products, accessibility, location, other convenience factors. Certainly price, absolutely. And so that's not something that keeps me up at night, because the path that we are on is headed that way.
So you tweeted this morning that, quote, so many state governments are hectically discussing social equity as we speak, and we have to learn from each other. So when you look at other states that have legalized recreational marijuana, who do you think is doing the best job to address equity concerns? And what are some of the lessons that the Massachusetts Commission can learn?
Well, I think that we are doing the best, and I don't think we're doing very well at all. So that means, then this is what I tell other states, what Massachusetts is doing is the bare minimum. And so if you look at Illinois, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, all of these states are, they're not, it's not the old model of we'll take what we can get with legalization. The people who are interested in equity are holding firm and saying we will not legalize unless it's done in a fair and inclusive way. And I think that's the right way to go.
So finally, last question for you. What would be your message to social equity or minority applicants right now?
Oh, I love that question. I would say participate in our feedback period. There are only two a year. We have one starting now. Tell us what your challenges are. Tell us what your barriers are. And we will systematically and individually address them.
And your next meeting is Thursday.
And our next meeting is Thursday.
All right. That's Shalene Title. She's a commissioner on the Cannabis Control Commission, and she serves in the social justice seat. Commissioner Title, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, who killed James Reeb, a Boston minister who was murdered during the civil rights movement? A new podcast investigates, and we'll talk to the folks behind it. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. In 1965, Selma, Alabama became the epicenter of the civil rights movement. Thousands of activists, both black and white, came together from all over the country to end racial discrimination at the ballot box. Among them was Reverend James Reeb, who came to Selma from Boston, answering a call from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. for religious leaders to join the protests. During his time in Selma, Reverend Reeb was brutally beaten and eventually died from his injuries.
Three white men were arrested today in Selma, Alabama, on charges of assault with intent to murder three white ministers on a downtown street corner in Selma, Alabama, last night.
No one has ever been held accountable for his murder, and there are conflicting stories about what happened the night he was attacked. The three men who were arrested in connection to this case went on trial in 1965 and were acquitted by an all-white jury soon after. Now, Reeb's death was one of the catalysts that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But one major question remains. Who killed James Reeb? Andrew Beck Grace and Chip Brantley are the hosts of a new investigative podcast from NPR. It's called White Lies, and it looks to uncover the truth behind Reeb's murder. They join us now from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Andrew, Chip, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. So first, there are some folks in Boston who know about James Reeb. And according to the Boston Globe, some 25,000 people turned out on the common for a vigil after his death. But for those who don't know his story, could you tell us a little bit more about him? Who was Reverend James Reeb, and what do we know about what happened to him?
So, yeah, so this is Chip. James Reeb was a Unitarian minister. He'd been he lived in Philadelphia and then Washington, D.C. And in 1964, he was called to kind of a more social Justice Faith and decided to leave All Souls Unitarian Church in D.C. and moved to Boston, where he worked for the American Friends Service Committee, and was really driven to, again, to become more engaged in his community. He moved to Dorchester, had really been turned on by there was a fire, a really horrible fire in 1964 down in that area. I believe it's called the Bellflower Street fire. And so he really worked on housing issues and tried to become more engaged in his community. And like millions of other Americans in March 1965, saw footage from Bloody Sunday out of Selma when Alabama state troopers attacked peaceful demonstrators on the Abbot Pettus Bridge, and was just moved to do something. And he was outraged when he saw the footage. And 2 days later, went to Selma along with many other Unitarians to show support for the marchers down there.
And what happened to him there?
Yeah, that's a good question. He arrived in Selma with a bunch of other ministers of all faith, really, came in to town on the Monday and Tuesday after Bloody Sunday. He arrived early Tuesday morning, and there was a march that was actually led by Dr. King that day. It's called Turnaround Tuesday because they get to the foot of the bridge where the protesters had been beaten, and then ultimately turn around as a show of solidarity, awaiting really the federal protection that would ultimately allow the successful Selma to Montgomery march to take place. So after Turnaround Tuesday, he's there at Brown Chapel AME Church, which was the sort of nerve center for the movement. He sees a lot of friends that he knows. He visits with people. And that evening, around 5 o'clock or so, he meets up with two other Unitarian ministers, Clark Olson and Orloff Miller, and they decide to go to dinner together. So they're walking they walk downtown, and they stop at a civil rights organization to ask where they should eat. And they are asked, would you like to eat with your own people or with African Americans, basically? And they say, well, we're here for solidarity, so we want to go to an African American restaurant. So they get sent to this place called Walker's Cafe. They have a dinner there. It's incredibly crowded with a totally mixed interracial crowd, which was a rarity for Selma at the time, especially for a black restaurant to have white patrons. And so they're there. They decide to leave to go back to hear Dr. King speak that night at Brown Chapel. And they decide to take what they think will be a quicker route back to the church, but going a different way than the way that they had originally come. They did not realize at the time that that route would take them by this place called the Silver Moon Cafe, which was a notoriously rough kind of segregationist bar. And so in front of that cafe, they're attacked by a group of men who yell racial slurs at them as they attack them. They're beat up. It's a very quick thing that happens there on the street. But one of those attackers swings a club at Reeb's head and hits him just devastatingly hard on the right at the temple of his head. And he falls to the ground. He's badly injured, kind of battling a little, but can sort of stand. And they walk him down the street back to the civil rights organization to get help, to get an ambulance to figure out what's going on with this injury. And that unleashes a sort of wave of different medical diagnoses at the early part of the night. And then they decide he has to go to Birmingham, which is about a 2-hour drive away. So they get an ambulance, and it's a complicated story from there. But that's ultimately what happens. And then he dies 2 days later in Birmingham.
It's Andrew, as you described there, that's truly a terrible thing that happened to James Reeb. And, you know, this is sort of at the intersection of race in America at that time. And you know, you both grew up in Alabama. I should note you're both white, and I'm just curious if you felt a certain obligation to get the truth out of this story.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so this, as you mentioned, Andy and I are both from Alabama. We were born in the generation after the civil rights movement proper, in the 70s. I'm a little bit older than Andy is. And, you know, so this is a story, of course, we in school and growing up here, we heard a lot about the events of the 1960s, but it is not something that I would say we talked about much in our communities, which is, as you mentioned, we're both white. So our white communities, we're not talking about the civil rights movement at all when we were growing up, except in the way that we all read about in textbooks in that time. And so I think, you know, for us, what was surprising when we first started to look into the story was that this you know, as you mentioned, there were 25,000 people who protested, who marched in Boston for a vigil for Reeb after he died. The president invoked Reeb's death in a nationally televised speech before both houses of Congress. It was front page news for weeks. This is a huge story in 1965. And it's a name, James Reeb, that we had never heard before in our lives growing up in Alabama. That was surprising to us. And as we began to get into the story, we began to find out some reasons about why that name is not so well known.
And that, why is
that? Of course,
that?
Being journalists. Well, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's curious. But here in the state of Alabama, especially in Selma where the attack took place, there was a trial. So the attack happened in March of 65. There was a trial in December of 65. And the three men who were tried were acquitted, which was, you know, you can – if you know anything about the civil rights era and the era of racial justice and or lack thereof in the South, it's an unsurprising thing that an all-white jury, an all-male jury would acquit these folks. But when you
had to be registered to vote in order to serve on a jury, and you couldn't register to vote, right? I mean, you talk
about
that in the
podcast. Dallas County, there were actually a handful of registered voters in Dallas County, African-American registered voters. But in neighboring Lowndes County, where the population was 80% black, there was a pretty legendary civil rights trial that happened there, and there wasn't a single black person called for the jury because there had never been a single black person that had been registered to vote in Lowndes County. But what happened in the trial is there was basically an argument presented at trial that these men didn't do the attack, which is a common argument for a trial. But the second argument was, even if they did do it, this man wasn't hurt badly enough in Selma for him to have died. And the civil rights movement had conspired either to delay medical treatment or to actually cause a further injury because they were in need of a white martyr. And that sounds shocking right now to hear that was a theory that was proposed, but it was a theory that was good enough to get those men off. And it was ultimately a theory that I think absolved so much. This is the argument that we sort of make in the show, that absolved white Southerners and white Selmians in particular of any responsibility of having to deal with the legacy of that violence. And honestly, I believe that's one of the reasons why that story is less known here in the state than it might be elsewhere, because for a certain number of people in the state, there was this sense that, oh, well, that, you know, that's a more complicated story. That's not there. You know, something else might have happened there. So really the attempt of our show is to really try to understand and unpack how that story came to be and to eviscerate it and explain the ways in which it's a lie, essentially.
Well, I want to play a clip here from the podcast. It's a collection of voices of folks who are describing what they believe happened in 1965 to James Reeb.
Stories that were flying around.
Anything that happens, there's always a second story.
They say, oh yeah, he really wasn't. It was the bad doctors or something like that.
Well, you know, did he hit his head on the pavement?
Slow ambulances to Birmingham.
I think they killed a man on the way to Birmingham. I'll always believe it.
And a lot of the first episodes are about how something you believe is true can turn out to not be the entire truth. And that last voice, quote, they killed a man on the way to Birmingham, he's of course referencing this pernicious conspiracy theory that you were just describing, Andrew, around Reeb's death. Do you disprove that theory in your reporting?
Yes, we do. Don't want to give away too much that's coming, but yeah, I mean, we, in this episode that actually came out today, episode 3, we really take that conspiracy theory, which has lived on in Selma through sort of a well-known propagandist in 65, really codified that conspiracy theory, and it still lives on. I mean, we can't tell you the number of times we have asked people about Jim Reeb and heard some version of that conspiracy theory.
And why do you think that conspiracy theory lives on?
Well, I mean, I think it's just never really been fully challenged. I mean, I think one of the things that was most intriguing to us about the story is the way in which the story, the sort of false story, the counter narrative of Reeb's attack and death in so many ways mimics the way that white folks have been able to not deal with the sins of the past. We can create an easy and convenient story that was a long time ago and it's not connected to us and there's no legacy of any of this injustice, and it can absolve us from ever having to deal with the past. And in the Reeb case, it's a very specific injury, and you can actually see the genesis of this lie and you can understand the way it operates. But more collectively for all of us, it feels as though we all need a sort of reckoning with what does the past mean and what's the legacy of the past. So I think that's been one of the things that's been most interesting for us, is the way in which the story about Reeb is mimics so much of the things we don't want to address or be truthful about the past.
So you mentioned, and we talked about this a bit, but President Lyndon Johnson, of course, he invoked Reeb's murder in his speech introducing the Voting Rights Act. And in some ways, Reeb's death helped catalyze support for the act. I just want to play a bit of tape here from LBJ.
Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
Did it take a white man's death for this bill to pass?
I don't know. I mean, we've wrestled with this. Yeah. I feel like it was just a perfect optics moment for Johnson. He was really concerned with what would happen to Reeb. I would say, maybe not ungenerously, he didn't necessarily care exactly what happened to Reeb, but knowing that the man was going to die presented this space for him to present to a more receptive nation at that moment, this really radical, at the time, a radical bill to essentially change the course of American history, especially in the Deep South. Now that the question is, you know, did the deaths of African Americans before Reeb, did they contribute in many ways to Americans' coming awareness of racial injustice? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. It just so happens that Reeb's death happens at this moment when it's more visible and more present.
Yeah, I mean, the eyes of the nation are on Selma at that moment because of Bloody
right.
Sunday. So the timing was terrible, but it was taken advantage of.
Well, that's Chip Brantley and Andrew Beck Grace. They're the hosts of White Lies, a new NPR investigative podcast about the murder of Reverend James Reeb. We have a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. I wish we had more time, guys. This is a fascinating story and a fascinating podcast. Thanks so much.
No, thank you for your time.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.